It is common for Astorians and others in Clatsop County to say that we don't have manufacturing in our economy. The truth is that manufacturers are well represented in our regional economy. They aren't as visible as major retailers, for instance, or hospitals, but they're here, and they are some of our most interesting businesses. My guests today are at both ends of the time spectrum of manufacturing. At 66 years, Lectro Incorporated is one of the oldest local manufacturers. I'll talk with Lectro's president, Eric Paulson. Then we'll talk with a much younger manufacturer, Fort George Brewery, which this week inaugurated its canning line. My guest will be Chris Nemlowell, Fort George's co-proprietor. Eric Paulson, welcome to After Deadline.
Steve, thank you very much. Enjoy being here.
Good, good. The life story of Lectro's founding and its growth is familiar in the lore of American enterprise. It's the story of a creative and prolific inventor who is eventually succeeded by his son, who brings business skills to the company. Fill out the details of Lectro's history, Eric, from your father's role and your journey toward taking over the company.
Very good. Well, my father, Wilt Paulson, started the company back in 1945, first in Beaverton as an aircraft repair facility, and then in 1948, he and my mother, Violet, relocated the company back to Astoria, which is where they were born and raised, and the two naval hangars at the airport. And shortly after being here, they were mainly focused on aircraft repair. Eventually got into some manufacturing, built one a wind machine to control slash burns for area contractors like Clatterboss, and then built a mink feeder for the audio company, Paul Audio, who had a mink ranch and needed a way to feed his mink, and the gasoline-powered vehicle that he had was scaring the mink, and they were eating their young. So he and Dad got together and built one of the first electric mink feeders. And they kind of went on to do other things. Dad built one of the first electric golf carts in the world. He built one of the first electric fork trucks that's here at the Daily Historian.
It's model one.
Exactly. And went on to do other things, including an aircraft tow tractor. And that's basically what is our main product today.
Mm-hmm. I've heard this story, Eric, about the golf cart. Your father was really ahead of his time inventing that golf cart, and then, as I remember this story, the Japanese moved in and just took that over.
Yeah, I mean, he was basically pioneering almost everything that he did. The small electric fork was pioneered, and this golf cart, he basically put a golf cart in the back of a trailer and went around to area golf carts, convincing people to golf courses, convincing people to use their golf cart. And then once there was a market for golf carts, yes, the Japanese and large companies like Harley Davidson and Yamaha came in and basically took it away from us.
Uh-huh. So when did the jet tug pull show up? When was that?
Dad built the first one in 1967 for a company in Portland, Flightcraft. Didn't do a lot in the way of marketing it until I came back from college in 1982. And the forklift was our main product line, and that was basically going away because of the economy. And again, for foreign competition, it was hard to compete against Toyota and Mitsubishi and Nissan. And this aircraft tug, we had a consultant that came along and said, hey, of all the products you've got right now, this aircraft tug seems to be one of the best ones that has the future in stake for you. So I did exactly what Dad did. I put a tug on the back of my trailer and went around peddling aircraft tugs. And now we're the world leader. We have tugs in almost every country in the world.
Let's talk about your sort of life journey into Lectro, into your family's company. Some fathers who have businesses take care to expose their children to the business. Some don't, that sort of thing. What was your earliest awareness of what your father was doing and the company?
Well, I always worked at Lectro. My entire life, that's what I did, every Saturday, Sunday, after school. So I knew all about the business, although I wasn't going to get into the business. I went to college to become a lawyer. But in junior high, I think we had this little quiz that you took that kind of decided or helped you look at your what your likes and dislikes were for occupation. My number one that came back was business. Number two was law. But again, didn't really think that was going to be the case. I was not going to run electro. But after 2 years of college, I went to Willamette University down in Salem. The courses I took were basically a lot of pre-law, economics, and business. And then the company got in financial difficulties. My dad's health deteriorated. So I decided to come back and see what I could do to help. Again, not thinking I was going to stay, just thinking I would help. And that was in 1982, and I was 19 years old.
Okay. And the rest, as they say, is history. This is After Deadline. My guest is Eric Paulson, president of Electro, Inc. Eric, you've alluded to your marketing of the jet tug. Am I right that Electro sells jet tugs to both private aircraft companies as well as military customers?
Yeah, we're getting we focused initially on the private sector. That was kind of the bread and butter of the product of the company. And lately, we're getting into the military industry. As a matter of fact, just last week I was meeting with the Air Force. We've done better with foreign militaries than we have with the U.S.
Why is that?
Well, the U.S. has a requirement that they need the old technology of using this tow bar. And our philosophy, our concept is we raise and nose the aircraft, eliminating this tow bar. And that was basically what Dad's design was. And that's what's unique to our product versus what's out there on the market today everywhere else. But we also did well with the airlines. So we were all civilian corporate aviation, and then we transitioned into the airlines back in the late 90s and the 2000s, and now we're hoping the next step is, in fact, the military, and it's looking promising.
Which foreign air forces do you sell to?
Right now, we're selling to Singapore. We sold to Belgium. We sold to Swiss. We sold to the Finnish Air Force, Malaysian, and even the UK, so and Canadians as well.
And which aircraft companies do you sell to?
Almost all the aircraft manufacturers right now use our product. So whether it be corporate aviation, the Gulfstreams and the Cessnas and the Pipers, the commercial aircraft, the Bombardiers and the Embraer, basically all the aircraft from 737s and A320 Airbuses on down is what we can handle. And most of the aircraft manufacturers use our product.
You travel more than anyone I'm aware of in Clatsop County. How much of the year are you on the road?
Well, a couple of years ago, I was gone about half the year. The last year, was probably about a third, and this year, it's less, only because I'm involved heavily in the Astoria Bicentennial and the Regatta, which is taking a lot of my time. But traveling, I was in Japan, of course, when the earthquake hit. A few years ago, I was in China when that earthquake hit. But I'm traveling all over the place. I go to the Middle East a lot. I do the Far East. I'll be going to Switzerland here in May. So I do, and domestically too. I'll hit some of the major airlines, and I'll do the air forces. So I travel wherever the market needs. And right now, about 80% of our market, our production went international in 2010, at least for a while there. So traveling abroad, which we first started in 1985, was my first international trip. I'm glad I planted these seeds back then, because with the U.S. economy, what it was the last couple of years, international sales definitely kept us afloat.
Now, when you ship jet tugs out of Astoria, how do they get abroad?
If they go international, a container comes in, and it comes right to our facility in Astoria. We load it in the container, 20-foot or 40-foot. And it's either sent out by truck and then maybe go to the Port of Portland and out from there, or to one of the other export seaports around the country.
Eric, you mentioned cultures as disparate as Japan and the Middle East. Business cultures tend to have their own set of customs and that sort of thing. How much education do you have to do to get by in those situations?
Education, as far as just kind of learning their culture, I guess, you know, business, the one thing nice about being in aviation is that English is the international language.
Sure.
English is the international business language. So I'm able to communicate in English predominantly wherever I travel. However, you do have to learn the culture. And in a lot of the areas like China, the Middle East, they don't buy quick. They want to know who they're dealing with, so it's a long kind of experience that we've got, a long relationship building. But once you have them as a customer, you've got them for life.
Gotcha. What is Lectro's employment? How many employees do you have?
Right now, we are hovering around 50, 55 employees. We've been as high as 75, but the recession cut us back. But we do almost everything here. So we do our engineering in-house. We do all the marketing. We do the development, the production, manufacturing. Everything is done here in Astoria, in Warrenton. But right now, we've been expanding. We've been adding employees consistently over the last couple of years now. So even in the economy, we are seeing a growth take place.
What percent of your workforce is welders?
Well, we probably have, of the 55 employees, there's probably 6 or 7 welders out there.
Oh, okay.
We have machinists, we have welders, we have drillers, we have painters. You know, we do the whole myriad. And then we have assembly people and electricians. So it.
Where do you get your skilled employees, such as welders or machinists?
They're getting harder and harder to find. That type of worker is not. Basically, it was being educated right now. But there are still the good thing is we don't have a lot of turnover. So we don't have to get welders on a regular basis. But the college has a welding program that they can come from there. There are people in the area that know how have those skills or are willing to come in. Lectro is kind of a unique company in what we're doing here, and we do give an alternative to the fishing and logging industry. And so, that kind of segment of work is still in demand for a lot of employees and a lot of people in the Clatsop County region.
Lectro, I suppose, could be located in many places, and I presume it's your family's link to Astoria that keeps it here.
Without a doubt. Lectro should not be in Clatsop County. Our market is not in Clatsop County. Our market isn't even in Oregon. Most of our market is, like I said, international right now. So we should be everywhere but Clatsop County. We are here because of our family's tie to the area. We also are here because we have good employees. And I'll put our employees up against any employee in the world, Japanese, German, it doesn't matter. We can produce a quality product here in Clatsop County and manufacture and distribute anywhere in the world and compete against any other country from a quality point of view. A cost point of view is another story.
Manufacturing is a big topic these days, and it's common for politicians to observe how much of America's manufacturing sector has shrunk. But at the same time, the federal government, of course, provides incentives for manufacturers to move abroad. What are the challenges you face as a manufacturer?
It's tough, Steve. You know, right now, one thing I'm seeing that a lot of the technology that we used to be able to find within the U.S., especially in regards to electric equipment, is being offshored. So we're having to look at other countries to help us with some technology advances, control systems, motor systems. So as the manufacturing base decreases in the U.S., it hurts the manufacturers that are left because we all kind of rely on each other. And I am a little bit concerned about the future for manufacturing if we keep offshoring. There's not going to be enough manufacturers left in which to help each other out. Exactly.
Right. Eric Paulson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Steve, thank you so much for the invitation.
When we come back from our break, we'll talk with Chris Nimlowell, co-proprietor of Fort George Brewery. Fort George Brewery has taken off like a rocket. Started in 2007, the business has moved beyond its original confines, and just this week has launched a canning enterprise. My guests are Chris Nimlowell and Jack Harris, co-proprietors of Fort George. Welcome to After Deadline, Chris and Jack.
Thank you.
One of the most striking things about your business is that you've taken two buildings that originally were part of an automobile dealership, and you've given them new life. I believe the architects call that adaptive reuse.
Yeah, what's been very fortunate for us is that the location where we started our pub, we've now been able to expand into the Lovell building across the parking lot. We can really tie the two businesses together, but the way that the buildings are set up, they're perfect for a large brewery. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's a small craft brewery, but a larger brewery.
Well, and I know initially when the pub opened, for a while you had a sense that this had been something else. There was a certain old car shop smell or something that seemed to be in there, but not now. I think, you know, enough time has elapsed that it's clearly yours now.
The thing that we really, that I fell in love with the first day I ever walked into the Fort George building was the just the massive old growth Doug fir beams up above.
Yeah.
Where we now have our bar and our pub. Uh-huh. And now over in the Lovell building, there's even bigger, more beautiful beams that yeah. we just love to be able to sit and stare at for hours if we can. But they're just gorgeous.
Well, your business is very much a matter of personal vision, or visions, plural. So let's talk for a second about how you got there, about your own personal odysseys. Who wants to start? Jack?
I started off with the McMenamins back in the 80s. I love going into McMenamins and making their eyes glaze over by telling some employee that I used to work there in the 80s. And they rolled
their. Been in Portland?
That was in Raleigh Hills.
Okay.
Raleigh Hills, and then I became a brewer at Cornelius Pass Roadhouse and kind of hung out with those guys for a couple of years. They taught me everything I knew, really, from the beginning. And then I got an opportunity to start a brew pub in Boulder, and I ran a brew pub in Boulder for about 3 years. But Colorado's beautiful, but it has no ocean.
True.
So I had to move back to Oregon, and I spent a year at Cascade Lakes in central Oregon, and then heard that they were tearing the old... Well, once I worked there, I always claimed they didn't tear down Bill's Tavern. They just stopped holding it up. And so when they rebuilt Bill's Tavern, they put a brew pub in there, and I lobbied to get that job and spent 9 years working at Bill's Tavern. And then that's where I met Chris. And I tried for years to find someone to open a brew pub in Astoria because I lived up here and I commuted down there, which is kind of a drag. But just driving up and down the coast every day. And so working with Chris, we came up with a plan, and that's how yeah. we got going up here.
So, Chris, you grew up in Astoria. You graduated from Astoria High School.
I did, in 1997. Graduated from Astoria High School. Actually went up to Clatsop Community College for a couple years. Got a transfer degree. Ended up down at Southern Oregon University and graduated in spring 2003 with a bachelor's degree in marketing and computer science. I was kind of lined up to go do an internship up in Portland with either I was going to go towards Intel or a marketing firm up in Portland, and I just felt like it wasn't necessarily the right direction for me, and I decided I wanted to buy about a half dozen books on how to brew beer and came back to Astoria and started homebrewing some beer with a couple of friends of mine, and then signed up for a study abroad program in the Netherlands to live over there and take international marketing grad classes. But I really was setting it up so that I could go and tour some breweries over there, came back and took some of the beer that I've been making down to Bill's Tavern. And that's where I met Jack and said, I'm interested in learning how to be a professional brewer. I want to see if there's any chance of me doing an internship here. And they ended up hiring me. Jack ended up hiring me down at Bill's Tavern.
Putting together the business side of your venture, did you have assistance from the Small Business Administration or Clatsop College, or did you kind of invent it all on your own?
Well, I got kind of lucky because I had just finished up business classes at Southern Oregon University, and our main project before we graduated was to put together a business plan. And so I'd been really educated in putting together business plans. I sat down, worked with Jack a lot on the business plan, and we came up together with a business plan on our own.
Now, the big event this week, of course, was the inauguration of the canning line, at least the public inauguration. It was there already. You installed it some time ago, I guess, and shook it down and all that sort of thing. How rare is it for a microbrewery to be canning its own product?
Our canning line actually is a pretty new thing. Before 2003, there were not a lot of craft breweries that were able to afford small canning lines. In 2003, there's a small company up in Canada called Cask Brewing Systems, and they developed a small automated canning line that craft breweries could afford. And so we have I think number 98 ever made of the small canning line. So they hadn't actually made 100 of them yet. But so it's kind of a renaissance that's going on right now in the craft brewing community.
I was referring to you as a microbrewery, and I hear you saying craft brewery. Is it the same thing, just a different term of art?
Yeah, it's there's people try to define it, but it's all in the industry what you're called a craft brewery or a microbrewery or a pub brewery. There's certain numbers of barrels a year that define like whether you're a microbrewery or a macrobrewery, but other than that, it's all semantics. It doesn't really matter.
Sure. Now, I presume that by canning beer, that extends your reach in terms of how you can sell your beer. It can be preserved longer, I presume, in the can, and it can travel more?
Yes, and we're also now able to make a little bit more. Last summer, we were really kind of just trying to keep up with our Clatsop County accounts, and then we were shipping out quite a bit to Portland. As of this week, there are many stores across the state of Oregon that now have 1811 Lager and Vortex IPA in cans.
How many give us an example of your reach and your prospective reach?
The majority of our beer outside Clatsop County is going to Portland and Salem. But as of this week, down, I believe it's in Ashland, Bend, and Eugene at some eclectic beer stores. But also, I know PC Market of Choice is picking it up, Whole Foods, New Seasons. And actually, as of today, we're in Safeway here in Astoria.
Wow. Wow. So what do you project would be your ultimate capacity of cans per beer per year? Cans of beer per year.
Wow, that's the way I like to think of it is our ultimate growth. I don't think Chris or I have an objective to be like the biggest brewery in Oregon or anything. There's plenty of people that can have that crown. But we've imagined beer is the analogy with Astoria being a canning town and the fish and the beer kind of ends with the longevity. Beer is a very perishable item, and the further away it gets from you, the less control you have over it, and the less quality you will find in beer that is shipped a long ways. It's very difficult to keep it good. And so we don't really imagine – the way I've always looked at it is beer, you never really buy a beer. You only rent it for a little while. So if we keep our beer in the Columbia drainage area, from Boise, maybe up to Seattle someday, down to Ashland, that whole Oregon kind of upper northwest area – all that's going to come right back by Astoria at some point as it flows down the Columbia River.
How many employees do you have?
28.
28 right now.
Wow. So you're already a mid-sized business.
Yeah, we opened our doors 4 years ago with 6.
Uh-huh. And what's the split between the pub and the brewery?
About 3/4 of the employees are in the pub. Quarter of them in the brewery. And then one thing that's great about us is we really have employees that flow all over the place. There are people who work in the brewery but also work on the floor in the pub, our new tap room. We have brewers and brewery employees working in there. It's a great mix.
When I was over last week looking at your line, your canning line, Chris, you talked about how disappointed you were that you couldn't buy your tanks domestically, that they were made in another country, and there was something, another major item in your manufacturing process, if that's the word, that had to come from another country, and that it was kind of sad, you thought, that this stuff isn't made in America. What were those? Can you remember?
Well, we definitely try to buy anything we can. A lot of our ingredients are very local, but I feel that I'm very excited to be locally manufacturing, part of local manufacturing. Our kegs, we did just order up some kegs that are coming from Germany. Mm-hmm. Our new brewing system was manufactured in Canada. There are a couple of manufacturers in the United States, but a lot of brewing equipment comes from Canada or Germany.
Yeah. Technically, we bought that from Texas. It was a used system. So like our buildings, it's the reuse, that it's the best form of recycling or being sustainable is to keep using equipment rather than building new stuff. So we bought it from Texas.
And our first system we bought used also. And that was actually built in Ohio, and then it went out to Virginia Beach, Virginia, and we bought that used.
Earlier in the show, our guest was Eric Paulson of Lectro. Excuse me. And he made an interesting point about the export of U.S. manufacturing jobs, one I'd never heard, I guess, which is the more that are exported, it's like the critical mass in the U.S. diminishes, and that it's important for there to be a number of manufacturers so that you can share ideas and share talent and equipment even. And if more and more goes abroad, there's just less here to bounce off each other. I suppose you're part of a community of brewers nationally who do the sort of thing you do.
Oh, yeah. And that's the nice thing about brewing is it is a real domestic strength right now. There's all sorts of resources and infrastructure that we can buy and sell and trade. And I mean, even right here in Astoria, we get short on, I think we're picking up hops from the Wet Dog today because we were short on hops. So it's very nice to have that going on. And
You're mentioning the Wet Dog. It reminds me, it's kind of amazing in this relatively small area of Clatsop County. What do we have, three craft brewers?
It's true.
Yeah. You and they and the Bill's Tavern.
Yep.
Yeah. Quite remarkable. The other aspect of the Fort George phenomenon, I'll call it that, is sort of a social one or a cultural one almost, where you have live entertainment. And, of course, you're also a gathering point. People come there to eat and visit and socialize and that sort of thing. But it seems like, especially with your neighbor, Blue Scorcher Bakery, side by side, suddenly that part of town that was dead because it was empty is a real magnet.
Well, it's been great because all the businesses around us really work with us. I think that the synergy that we have on the entire block now with Claude and Chris up with the Fernhill Glass and the Blue Scorcher, none of us take away from each other. We all just bring more people to the area. It's exciting.
Who is your customer? I mean, you have two sets of customers now. I realize that you've got customers who are buying your cans of beer, but also you have the customer that walks into the pub. Who are they? How would you describe the split between local and visitor and so forth?
That ratio changes, of course, during tourist season, but it's just about anybody. We get grandmas, we get 21-year-olds, we get and everybody in between. It's really remarkable. Kids are in there all the time. It's very kid friendly, and families. It's really hard to pin that down. I can't think of people that don't go there.
Mm-hmm. How do you book your acts, your entertainment?
Heidi Johnson is a local.
Your booking agent.
That does all the booking. She does a fantastic job. We didn't want to have the same band necessarily playing every single week, and we wanted to rotate local and non-local acts to come in.
Gotcha.
And really mix it up.
Yeah. Well, we've been speaking with Chris Nemlowell and Jack Harris of Fort George Brewery, and thank you both very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.